Energy Stew with Peter Roth, Thursdays at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to Energy Stew. This is Peter Roth, your host. And do you really believe in reincarnation? Do you really? Well, I do. And to help move us along on that subject, there's a wonderful book that is just being published this week, and it's called The Modern Book of the Dead. And I have the author online, Ptolemy Tompkins. Ptolemy, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, I'm so glad. Now, you and I have a similar history having to do with our fathers.
Oh, boy.
Not quite the same. Your father was into reincarnation. My father, it's just, we both were curious as young people as to, you know, where our dads went after they passed on.
When did your dad pass on? I know I'm not supposed to be interviewing you, but...
I was 17 at the time.
Wow.
I didn't want to lose him, so I was trying to figure out where he must have gone and what's out there. And so that's been a theme of my life. There's a lot I believe in, and your book really helps understand the subject matter a great deal and the history of understanding reincarnation and how long these ideas have been around. Maybe they're around because it's true.
Well, I think reaction to death is pretty much the oldest human reaction one can think of. I mean, it's a pretty short list of other things as universal and as ancient. It goes right back to the beginning. I mean, no matter how far back you go, you have people who care about each other, whether they're related or not, and then you have one of them dying, and then you have those questions arising. I mean, it's just, whatever one thinks about it, it's very hard to argue that it's not one of the absolutely central human questions, if not the one.
Right. And there's so much evidence out there short of first person being there. There's near-death experiences, but that's not conclusive because those people came back, so we don't know quite if they had the same experience as if you really die.
Well, there's so much experience. It's like, there's a guy named, Neil Postman, who wrote a book called Technopoly. It came out a few years ago, and he talks about how much information there is in our world today. And he introduced me to a term called inert information, which I thought was a fabulous term because it basically means we live in a world of so much information today that it's kind of like we're standing down in the basement and the water is flooded and we're up to our waists with this just stuff everywhere, coming in from the internet and et cetera and so forth. And he makes this fascinating, or I thought it was a fascinating point, that at a certain point, information isn't really such a great thing because the human mind is not made to process all the information in the world. And at a certain point, we just get stymied by the information, and we just kind of sit there. I mean, if you go to a restaurant or a bar in the old days, people would sort of discuss things. Now they can't really discuss things so much because they're too busy checking the internet to get the answer to what, you know, who did win the World Series or whatever. There's no discussion about it. Somebody else mentioned this to me the other day. I thought it was a really, you know, valid point. There's not as much discussion, as much getting to answers because everybody is just simply trying to sort of reach around and pick up the answer that's supposed to be right there. But this takes away at a certain point, and I think that's really the case with evidence for survival. There is so much of it. And the weird thing is there was this amazingly large and compelling amount of it that was published in the first part of the 20th century. I was born in 1962. I had no idea that so many people were reading about issues of reincarnation and life after death and what happens to the human personality, et cetera, in 1930, in 1925, in 1941. That there were all these books, very smart ones a lot of the time. But, you know, there's just so many of them, and then they kind of passed out of fashion. And then you had the new vogue for near-death experiences, you know, that came in with the 70s and stuff like that. And you have all this new stuff and the stuff we kind of associate with the new age and that coming in. And a lot of that's good and fascinating. But I wrote the book because I just thought, when my dad died, I think I have a line in the book that says something like, when my dad died, I realized that I knew too much about the afterlife and too little. Because, you know, my dad raised me thinking about that stuff. And there he is dead, just like the situation with you. You immediately, your mind asks that question. And I had 1,000,000,000 little kind of vague answers, etheric body, astral body, you know, this is what Christianity thinks, this is what Islam thinks. But it was too much. And what I realized what I wanted was a simple picture, something I could just keep in my head and not forget about. And that's what I tried to do in the book, is kind of sketch that picture.
Well, another thing that could have happened, he could have just shown up in an image in front of you and said, here I am, you see, I haven't gone anywhere.
Well, you know, if I were a little more sensitive, I'm sure that would have happened. But I'm a book person. I like reading about things, and I'm usually not as good at actually doing them. And I'm not, you know, I know people who see things, and I think it's, you know, without question a reality. But I tend to sort of find my way into them by reading about others' experiences. I was waiting. I was thinking he might sort of show up, but I think I'm too dense a soul to sort of pick up on that kind of thing. I mean, that's the kind of people who write books, I guess, because, you know, the people who have the immediate experience, they don't worry about it because they just see it.
Back in 1960, after my father died, I was watching TV, and this was only maybe days after he died, and on TV it said, and your father just died. And then as soon as it said that, the TV went into a static that it never did and never did again. And I said, oh, my gosh, that's my father telling me he's here. And I don't know. I mean, it could have just been a coincidence, but it meant a lot to me.
Yeah. Well, you probably think it's not coincidence, I would imagine. And, you know, I would suspect you're probably right. I mean, you probably know this, doing a show like this. There's funny little things like that happen to so many people when somebody dies. There's this little funny hint that shows up, and it's small, but it's not small. It's small enough where if you tell it to somebody else who doesn't believe in that kind of thing, they'll just say, you know, for heaven's sakes, it's just like a coincidence. But it's big enough to convince the person that it happens to. You know, it's not like, you know, spaceships don't land and the house doesn't burn down. It's a subtle little thing, but to the person who experiences it, it's often completely convincing because they can just see. They feel the significance of it.
Right, and we can be grateful for that, too, because we do need those kinds of things.
And oh, yeah.
Also, I work intuitively, and I understand how intuition works, so I know that we're not just lodged in our brains. And you talk about that in the book, and I think that's very important for people to understand. I mean, this book covers so many aspects of who we are, and what we're here for, and why we're here, and it's wonderful to read about. It's a lot of information that I've also pondered over the years myself, and have opinions about, and I thought you did a great job of discussing it.
Thank you.
And I think it's important for us to realize that when we die, we think, well, our brain is where the action was, so the brain is dead, so therefore we're dead. And you talk about how the brain isn't the only thing.
Well, I think, I mean, a person like you, a person like me, my suspicion is that we are both, just because of where we grew up and the place we grew up, I mean, you know, the time and place we grew up, we're default materialists, whether we want to be or not, because materialism just gets pounded into our head. In 20th century America, in the most subtle of ways, from childhood on, materialism is a very subtle thing. I mean, I know that I am in most basic ways a materialist because it's just what my culture taught me to be before I was able to say anything back. It's just it's one of the programs we grow up with.
It's a survival mechanism, actually, to manage our material reality.
Well, there are those arguments, like all the Tuxley used to talk about, you know, one of the reasons we have this sort of, we wrestle people, that you know, this materialism to a certain degree has always been around because we get thrown down here onto the material plane and we have to focus on the material or we will get eaten up or,
exactly.
or beaten up or something bad will happen. Yeah, yes, definitely.
So it's it's important then to understand that, to respect this life and respect that, you know, understanding this nature is good. But what about understanding that you know, the greater nature of who we are, and that's what your book focuses on.
Well, that's another, I mean, there's I guess my book wrestles with a bunch of New Age truisms that I also grew up with because my dad wrote The Secret Life of Plants, and I, you know, came of age in the 70s. It was a very New Age environment, and I'm kind of wrestling with certain basic ideas that were handed to me when the New Age really started taking off in the 70s, one of which is like, you know, we're here to learn. And, you know, the response of a semi-intelligent 14-year-old to we're here to learn is like, well, what are we supposed to learn? That the world is an awful place? Like, why does it suck so much so often? You know, that is that just, is that statement, we're here to learn, a superficial statement, or is it actually true, and can it be approached in a deep way? I think it can, but I think that idea sometimes gets sold out a bit by people who say it too easily. Like, this is just a magical, mystical place. And, well, you know, it's not so magical and mystical over in Darfur all the time. It's, you know, the world is a really terrifying, horrific place in many ways. What about that?
Sure.
You know, is there a way we can absorb those sort of that New Age wisdom along with absorbing the fact that the world is a pretty, you know, tricky place?
Not only that, but everybody suffers. And,
yes.
And the people who don't are in denial.
Yes, of course. Absolutely.
So, and you talk about that, too, about what the purpose of life is.
Right.
And I think it's very valuable to hear it from you, because people do hear it from me a lot, and I'm, you know, I talk about how primitive our society is, and we better be learning.
What do you tell them the purpose of life is? What's your
Well, I think it's the same thing. It's growth through adversity,
right?
And to build compassion and deeper love and awareness of our souls.
You know, I think that's true, but I guess my book is kind of me agreeing with that but then saying to myself, okay, if I do agree with that, what's necessary for me to be able to agree with that with all of myself? You know, I remember when I was in college, people would stay up late and drink some beer and have philosophical conversations and get the world all totally sewed up, and we'd sort of understand what life was all about. And then, you know, you'd wake up late on Sunday morning, you'd have a hangover, and it wouldn't really be helping you out that much anymore. And I think one of the things that sort of human life is about is learning how to take these things which we intuitively recognize are true and recognizing them with all of ourselves, you know, completely understanding the truth of them, which means living them every day. I guess it was Rilke who used to talk about living into the answer of a question. You know, you can answer it quickly and easily in a certain way, but in another way, it takes you your whole lifetime to say yes, to you know, understand that answer.
Well, to me, it's about relaxing into your own philosophies and embracing it in a lifestyle. And I find it, you know, easy and hard at the same time. I love living a multidimensional life, and we still have to live on this plane. And just yesterday, I was talking to someone who said, I'm not afraid of dying at all.
Right.
It's just how I'm going to get there that I'm worried about.
Sure.
And I think that's the process, is that no matter who we are, we still have to deal with being here now. And we can have all these great ideas about afterlife and all that, and yet, you know, what is it doing for us today in terms of whatever pain or conflict we're in?
Absolutely. And the other question about that a statement like that is, do you really believe it? I mean, I've heard people talk about, oh, death, it's nothing, it's a simple transition and that kind of stuff. And then when it comes down to it, you know, does that end up still being the case, or do you sort of forget about all that stuff? You know, suddenly, I've been in situations where, you know, very eloquent New Agey people were in the middle of sort of telling me about what life was all about, and then something scary happens, and they completely panic. I remember this, you know, I won't mention any names, but, you know, something like this happened to me when I was in my 20s. And I was like, wait a minute, you know, this person just completely freaked out. And I was like, wait a minute, you were just explaining to me about, you know, the great, the you know, the magical karmic universe, and there's nothing to be afraid of, and we're all safe. And then you just got all freaked out about this thing that just happened. You know, I guess that's the kind of sensibility that's like that kind of situation was what led me to write the book in a certain way, because I grew up really wanting to believe the truths of the New Age and being suspicious of them at the same time.
Sure.
And it's sort of middle age now, and I embrace the New Age and am still suspicious of it. I think both of those poles, you know, both of those poles are valid. You know? Basically, I'm with you. Basically, my philosophy is the same as yours.
And you saw that in your father as well.
I did. I hope I didn't. You know, it's sort of difficult when one writes about one's. I always end up writing about my dad, and I sometimes wonder whether I, you know, at one point I'm building him up, and at another point I'm sort of knocking him down. But I guess that's sort of inevitable with parents. But my dad, I mean, that's one of the reasons I thought it was okay to write about him at such a length in the introduction of the book, because he really did sort of illustrate all these questions for me, because he was a confident cosmic talker who, you know, when tax time came around, suddenly got into a bad mood and was yelling all the time. I said, well, what happened to all the cosmic oneness? You know, everybody, you know, shut up. It's April 15th. Where are my taxes?
I understand that completely. And I think most people do, is that, and I think people who don't understand that are not grounded. And I think being grounded on this plane, we need to do that in order to make better choices and to keep our prosperity going.
Yeah, there is something about that being grounded here. Reading a lot of the sort of the older books that I was talking about that were published sort of in the first half of the 20th century, they really talk about that a lot, about how you really do, you can't, once you get here, you can't just be trying to sort of crawl out of here and get away from here. You have to sort of pitch your tent on the earth and make your peace with this existence here and really figure it out. You can't just sort of want to be spirited away from it. There's a reason, you know, there's another New Age cliche, you know, there's a reason we're here. But, you know, I believe it is true that, you know, that New Age cliche is in fact correct. There is a reason we're here. But it makes it so much more easy to be here if you can keep really in your mind and in your belief the idea that there's another place. I mean, I think it's so, I can't believe how my materialist friends get through the day when they think that this is it. You know, I mean, they think I'm nuts too, but I don't understand how they manage it. Because on many days, if this were just it, I would really be pretty bummed out.
Sure. No, I agree. And I'm so glad that I have so many times, almost daily, where the universe is, you know, higher dimensional consciousness is obvious to me. And,
yeah.
And I realize, you know, we're not alone here.
Right.
And you have so much in your book of channeling, of some of the people who were questioning all this, and then they died, and then they're channeling through other people what's going on out there.
Well, there was a tremendous amount of this going on, again, I keep using this phrase, the early part of the 20th century, but it's kind of true. Like, especially after, I'm sure you know this, like after World War I, so many people were asking about this because so many young people lost their lives and so many wives, parents, siblings were unable to face the idea that somebody in their prime of life was just gone. People were really looking into this, and there was a lot of channeling going on. It was, you know, all called by different names back then, but there was a real sort of a network was kind of starting to be built up where people realized that it would be important, it would be really useful to humanity at large if it could just be proved that there was really some truth to this, and that many people could be helped by the establishment of the reality of the personality existing beyond death. And people were struggling to prove this. It's such a weird story, like how much evidence was amassed, yet at the same time, you know, how much good did it do, and how much good did the big vogue of channeling in the 70s and the 80s do? There's still so many people who walk around now thinking that, oh, well, there's no evidence. People have always tried to find it, but you can't find anything. Well, that's not true exactly. There's an incredible amount of evidence, but it's weird evidence. You can't prove it like you can prove that 2 plus 2 equals 4 or by doing some chemical experiment. That's what I find so fascinating about the history of this stuff.
Well, to me, though, I just wanted to interject that...
Don't let me talk too much.
No, I love it. You're doing a great job. As an intuitive, people come in to see me, and they can be scientists and lawyers or whatever, and, you know, who are very non-believers, and I sit down and I start telling them things that I shouldn't be able to know.
Oh, interesting.
And that goes on day after day. I do that every day with people, giving them information, intuitive information, that it's like, oh my God, where did that, you know, and so I think part of my job is just to show people that if I can know it, then it's out there in the universe, and it's beyond their brains, and so their brains are not limited.
So what is your experience doing this on such a regular basis with people who are initially resistant to the idea that stuff like that exists? Do you find that you do change a lot of people's minds, or are people who are inclined against it pretty much just going to forget about whatever you did after a couple
people,
of weeks?
Sometimes they just think I'm a freak, that's all.
they just won't take it.
No, they believe that it's something different that is happening, that it's out of their understanding.
But then they just pigeonhole it.
Well, they don't know how to deal with it.
And right. So yeah. they just it's like denial.
It's just a glitch in their brain.
Exactly.
Yeah, and so that's the only way they can understand it, as a glitch. I wanted to talk about Walt Whitman because he's one of the transcendentalists that you speak of in the book, and as well as Emerson and Thoreau, and those great writers were people who really could talk with us like this.
Well, I keep mentioning Whitman in the book because Whitman kind of, this book brings in a remarkable list of subject matter on which I don't know enough. I mean, as I was writing it, I was, you know, running around, I felt like I was sort of like falling through space, grabbing at different things, because there's so much to know about, and at a certain point I realized I just had to kind of charge ahead and do my best and realize that I couldn't get my head around the topics that I wanted to get my head around enough. Whitman is one of those, but he, you know, I really don't know a great deal about Whitman, but I know enough about him to know that he wanted to put together this kind of genuinely American spirituality that embraced the wisdom of the East that was just coming into America then, you know, the first translations of the Bhagavad Gita and Upanishads and all that, you know, Whitman, Emerson, Thoreau had copies of. This stuff was just entering in, and those guys knew that this was going to go somewhere in America. That Christianity in some way needed this infusion from the East, and it was going to produce this new thing. And for them, it was very much, I think, going to be this American spirituality. You know, and one of the questions, it's not the subject of the book, but it's one of the subtexts, is like, what is our genuine American spirituality? Because America should... Spirituality is one of the things that America has always been absolutely all about. You know, what's the new view of the soul? That's one of the things that America was created to figure out. I mean, it's just in our narrative from the beginning. And Whitman, I think, was very conscious of this.
And by the way, I just want to say that your book is a great contribution to that.
Oh, thank you.
Yes. So, and Whitman, certainly, Whitman and Emerson, I mean, they all showed that they were definitely dedicated to this. One quick anecdote about Whitman. The other day I was...
That's a good slip.
Right. The other day I was seeing clients, and one woman came, a guy came in the morning, and he said, I just decided I'm going to write a new book. It's going to be about Walt Whitman. And so, that's great, you know, okay. So a couple hours later, another client came in, and she said, I'm about to publish my book of channelings of poems from Walt Whitman.
Oh, here we go. Yeah.
And that was quite amazing. And I know her, you know, she is an automatic writer, and it's amazing the poetry that's coming through, signed Walt Whitman.
This raises a question that I have to bring up because it's so fascinating. And this is another thing my dad introduced me to. I remember I was walking with my dad at some point, I guess when I was a teenager, and he said, you know, Eliot has come up with a book of posthumous poetry. And he said it in the most matter-of-fact way. You know, T.S. Eliot has produced. Well, my dad could not quote a single line of the poetry that T.S. Eliot wrote when he was alive. But now that he was dead, my father was perfectly willing to accept that he was producing some more poems than they were being channeled. And I remember thinking in my critical way, this is just, you know, this is so idiotic. And one of the fascinating things about channeled poetry, channeled artwork, is that there's, I don't know about your friend, but there's often a mix of stuff that's just bad, that isn't like them, along with something that is.
Right. It could be any discarnate soul that wants to sign, that wants to talk to this woman and sign it Walt.
But the funny thing is, because the personality, I think the answer to it, or part of the answer, is that the human personality is such an enormous entity. I mean, we're in touch with so little of ourselves most of the time down here, but the individual human personality is so just galactically enormous that when we get out of our body, there are all these parts of us, some parts we leave behind, some parts go here. In fact, somebody who's channeling sort of Walt Whitman poetry in some New Age channeling session could actually be producing aspects that are, you know, genuinely Whitman. The personality, it's not just was Walt Whitman there or not, because the personality is so large once it gets out of the physical envelope that it's a much more complex question.
And there's so much for us to talk about, and we only have a half an hour. I hope we can do another show soon, because I want to get deeper into the questions that come up from reading your book and some of the deeper stuff. That is beautiful, and it's a shame that we're only kind of introducing your book right now.
Well, I appreciate your introducing it.
Well, sure, and hopefully you'll come back and do another show with me sometime soon.
I'll be delighted anytime.
Oh, good. By the way, later in that day, a new client came in, and it turned out he was a poet, and he said his best friend was the head of the Walt Whitman House out on Long Island.
Uh-huh.
So I had three people in one day who were connected in some way with the idea of Walt Whitman.
It's funny the way those things work.
Well, that's the universe at work, and that's, you know, so these are, you know, there's so many questions, and you know, I love the opportunity that I had in reading your book, The Modern Book of the Dead, and it's actually being published this week, and it's in your name, of course, the author. You're Ptolemy Tompkins, P-T-O-L-E-M-Y, Tompkins, and T-O-M-P-K-I-N-S. How can people reach you? Do you have a website?
I'm pretty unreachable at the moment, I guess.
Okay.
But I'm figuring that out because the Internet just confuses me. But I'm being persuaded to slowly put together my website.
Okay.
Slowly but surely.
All right. I'm looking forward to talking with you about some of these deeper issues that are in your book. It's great. It's great to talk about them with you and give people a handle so they can run out and buy your book.
Well, that would be great. Thanks so much for having me today.
Yeah. Well, thank you. It's been great that you have been a guest on Energy Stew, and I'm looking forward to talking with you again.
Terrific.
Yep. And this is Peter Roth, your host of Energy Stew at Progressive Radio Network. And I can be reached at peter@heartriver.org. And heartriver.org is my website. I can also be reached at 212-222-7748. And we have classes and all kinds of good things to offer. And I'm very happy to hear from you. So thank you very much for listening.